Signature and Credit Suisse alone, taking up more than $800 billion. The largest backstop for the repo market that the Fed operated during the crisis was the Primary Dealer Credit Facility, PDCF. It was introduced after the run on Bear Stearns under the emergency 13-3 powers of the Fed. The PDCF offered the key operators in the repo market discrete and unlimited access to overnight Fed liquidity in exchange for a wide range of collateral. Not surprisingly, the dealers took ample advantage. Total lending under PDCF came to $8.951 trillion. This was a huge amount, but the loans were made overnight, and they should be seen in relation to the daily collateral posting in repo markets that peaked at $4.5 trillion in March 2008. The maximum amount outstanding on the PDCF was, on September 26, 2008, at $146.57 billion. PDCF had the distinction of being the only large Fed liquidity program to have supported predominantly American banks. Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Bank of America were the heaviest users. But appearances were to a degree deceiving, because the Fed allowed the London-based subsidiaries of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and Citigroup to take advantage of the program. The Fed was thus remotely backstopping the City of London repo market. When the crisis in the money market funds knocked the last remaining support out from under the commercial paper market, the Fed took the unprecedented decision not just to backstop banks and the mutual funds, but to enter the lending business directly. It established its own SPV, the Commercial Paper Funding Facility, to buy top-quality short-term commercial paper. In total, it provided $737 billion in funding through this facility, with a peak outstanding in January 2009 of $348 billion. The largest user of the system was the troubled Swiss giant UBS, which soaked up 10% of the Fed's funds. Another 7.3% went into Dexia, and 5% each into Fortis and RBS. Some of the most severely stressed European banks received 27% of the entire program. In total, the European share cannot have been much less than 40%. Alongside the mortgage market, the broader market for asset-backed securities had frozen up. To re-energize lending on November 25, 2008, the Fed introduced the Term Asset-Backed Securities Loan Facility, which became the vehicle for the most mixed bag of lending sponsored by the Fed and the Treasury. It offered five-year non-recourse loans to a select group of borrowers collateralized through the purchase of highly rated securitizations of consumer credit, such as auto loans, student loans, credit card loans, and lending to small businesses for equipment and building construction. It was never the Fed's largest program. Total lending came to $71.09 billion. But the program accommodated some of the most adventurous support actions undertaken by the Fed. The firms taking advantage were exclusively American, with Morgan Stanley, PIMCO, and CalPERS in the lead. Finally, in early 2009, the Fed began to move from emergency liquidity provision to what would subsequently be known as QE1, the buying up and holding on the Fed balance sheet of large quantities of mortgage-backed securities. For a central bank, buying securities was a conventional mechanism of monetary policy, but it would now be done on a far larger scale than ever before, and with a wider array of assets. On top of the conventional purchase of treasury securities, the Fed bought $1.85 trillion in GSE-backed, mortgage-backed securities by July 2010. The busiest week of purchases was the third week of April 2009, and holdings, net of sales, peaked in June 2010 at $1.129 trillion. Crucially, what the Fed was doing was not just pumping liquidity into the system. It was also absorbing onto its balance sheet the maturity mismatch, which had done such damage in markets like ABCP. The Fed took the long-term asset in exchange for immediate liquidity. Quantitative easing, or QE, is generally thought of as the quintessential American policy, the symbol of the Fed's adventurousness. It would earn Bernanke regular scolding by conservative policymakers in Europe. But after what we have already said, it will come as no surprise that 52% of the mortgage-backed securities sold to the Fed under QE were sold by foreign banks, with Europeans far in the lead. Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse were the two largest sellers, outdoing all their American rivals by a healthy margin. Barclays, UBS and Paribas came in 8th, 9th and 10th. Having kept open the basic institutions of transatlantic shadow banking during the most acute phase of the crisis in 2008, the Fed now worked hand in glove with the European megabanks to unwind the transatlantic balance sheet. Not everyone in the network of Atlantic finance could take advantage of the facilities that the Fed offered to the top tier of international banks in New York, nor did everyone have the kind of collateral the Fed demanded. To have lent to the most fragile European banks without adequate collateral would have exposed the Fed to serious risk. But to deny the weakest banks liquidity assistance was to court disaster. So from 2007, the Fed repurposed an instrument that was first developed in the age of Bretton Woods. To manage the fixed currency system in the 1960s, the central banks had developed a system of so-called currency swap lines that allowed the Fed to lend dollars to the Bank of England against a reverse deposit of sterling in the accounts of the Fed. Having gone out of use in the 1970s, the swap lines had been briefly revived in 2001 to deal with the aftermath of 9/11. In 2007, faced with the implosion of the transatlantic banking system, they were repurposed and expanded on a gigantic scale to meet the funding needs not of sovereign states, but of Europe's mega banks. As Geithner explained to his Fed colleagues, "We have a bunch of US affiliates of some of the weakest European institutions that have faced very substantial dollar funding needs and have come to us and asked for substantial ongoing access to liquidity. When they have a substantial amount of collateral with substantial market value relative to the needs, we have been comfortable meeting those needs, above all through the TAF program discussed earlier. When their needs have substantially exceeded or might potentially exceed the market value of their eligible collateral, then we have talked to the home central bank. We have said that, in effect, if you want us to be able to meet those needs and they have collateral in your market that is substantial relative to those needs, then the better way for us to do this is for the home country central bank to meet their dollar liquidity needs against the collateral there, and we provide the dollar's worth of guarantees from the central bank." Having reached the limit of the dollars it could provide directly to Europe's tottering banks, the Fed now lent to the ECB, the Bank of England, the National Bank of Switzerland, and the central banks of Scandinavia. They then channeled the precious dollar liquidity to the European megabanks at one remove. The Fed and the central banks it was supporting agreed on an exchange rate. The European central bank, needing the dollars, deposited the required amount of local currency in an account in the name of the Fed. The Fed credited the European central bank with the equivalent amount in dollars. The two sides agreed to reverse the trade at a future date at the agreed exchange rate. The terms were spelled out with a minimum of fuss in a contract running to no more than 7 pages. The Fed received an interest premium that ensured that the swap lines would be used only if market funding was not available. The European central banks passed that cost on to the banks that were the ultimate recipients of the dollars. The initiative for the swap line program came from the Fed. In the aftermath of the disastrous Paribas announcement in August 2007, the Fed was seeing regular early morning spikes in European dollar funding costs that were causing disruption when the US markets opened in the middle of the European trading day. Tellingly, the ECB's initial reaction was skeptical. As one American journalist put it, the Fed's proposal ran up against a strong effort on the part of the ECB to pin the Great Panic on the United States. The ECB's reply to the Fed was blunt. "It's a dollar problem. It's your problem." As Bernanke was later to remark, the ECB had some difficulty coming to the realization that Europe would be under a great deal of stress and was not going to be decoupled from the United States. With regard to the swap lines, that attitude did not last much beyond 2007. The first agreements were reached with the ECB and the Swiss National Bank in December 2007. As the crisis became critical in September 2008, the swap facilities were rapidly expanded to a total capacity of $620 billion. On October 13, 2008, as the Europeans rolled out their guarantee programs and Paulson, Bernanke and Geithner persuaded America's bankers to take their dose of TARP capital, even that cap was lifted. Four central banks, the ECB, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and the Swiss National Bank, were given unlimited access to dollars. The swap lines helped to reassure markets, but they also threw a shadow of doubt over those central banks that had not been so favored. The shutdown in the money market was affecting the entire financial system. Where were the major emerging market central banks to get their dollars from? For a nation like South Korea to have approached the IMF was out of the question, given live memories of the Asian financial crisis of 1997 to 1998. So on October 29th, the Fed's favor was extended to four key emerging market central banks, Brazil, Korea, Mexico, and Singapore. All told, 14 central banks would be included in the program. The total amount outstanding on the network of dollar swap lines reached its peak in December 2008 at $580 billion. Briefly, the swaps touched 35% of the Fed's balance sheet. But even these gigantic figures do not do justice to the scale of the program. The essence of the swap line was to provide easy access to short-term dollar funding. With the New York Fed and its counterparts across the world working on a hectic schedule, new dollar funding was flushed into the system on a daily basis. In a single week in late October 2008, as dollars previously sourced from American money markets hemorrhaged out of the global banking system, the Fed lent $850 billion through the swap lines. It was this circulation of funds that allowed the Bank of England, the ECB, and the Swiss National Bank to meet huge demands for dollars without running down their exchange reserves to even more critical levels. But for the swap facilities, between September 2008 and May 2009, monthly demand for dollars at the auctions organized by the ECB would have wiped out its reserves several times over. The absence of a euro-dollar or a sterling-dollar currency crisis was one of the remarkable features of 2008. It was no accident. It was the swap lines that did the trick. What the Fed had done for money markets, the central banks now did for the global provision of dollar bank funding. They absorbed the currency mismatch of the European bank balance sheets directly onto their own accounts. Compensating public action ensured that private imbalances did not spill over into a general crisis. The scale of the compensating credit flow was staggering. By September 2011, total lending and repayment under the terms of the swap facility came to $10 trillion at varying lengths of maturity. Standardized to a 28-day term, the sum was equivalent to $4.45 trillion in one-month loans. On either measure, by far the largest beneficiary of the swap lines was the ECB. Every cent of this staggering flow of funds was repaid in full. Indeed, the Fed made profits of around $4 billion on its swap lending in 2008 to 2009. But this sober accounting understates the drama of this innovation. Responding to the crisis in an improvised fashion, the Fed had reaffirmed the role of the dollar as the world's reserve currency and established America's central bank as the indispensable central node in the dollar network. Given the even vaster volume of daily transactions in global financial markets, it is not the sheer size of the effort that mattered. The Fed's programs were decisive because they assured the key players in the global system, both central banks and large multinational banks, that if private funding were to become unexpectedly difficult, there was one actor in the system that would cover marginal imbalances with an unlimited supply of dollar liquidity. That precisely was the role of the global lender of last resort. Prior to the crisis, the transatlantic offshore dollar system had lacked a manifest center of leadership. Indeed, it had developed offshore so as to avoid national regulation and control. After 2008, it was openly organized around the Fed and its liquidity provision. In a way, one European central banker remarked, we became the 13th Federal Reserve District. But if that was the case, the American public was not informed about the extension of their country's monetary territory. Not the least remarkable thing about the Fed's crisis response was its politics, or rather the lack of explicit political legitimation. The emergency liquidity provision to the international economy by the Fed between 2007 and 2009 was shrouded in as much obscurity as possible. In July 2009, when Bernanke was challenged by campaigning Democratic Congressman Alan Grayson of Florida to explain who got the swap line money, the chairman of the Fed could reply, I don't know. The ultimate destination of the trillions of dollars that have flushed back and forth between the central banks of the global system was not under direct American oversight. There was little doubt, of course, that the Swiss National Bank channeled the dollars it received from the Fed to its ailing giants UBS and Credit Suisse, but from the point of view of the Fed, it was far better that the swap be done with a central bank than with the fragile banks themselves. As Neil Irwin describes it, the scale of lending to foreign banks was a closely guarded secret even by standards of the always secretive Fed. During the panic, this information was so closely held and had it been known publicly so potentially explosive that only two people at each of the dozen reserve banks were allowed access to it. The Fed used every legal means at its disposal to prevent detailed information about its support programs to both domestic and foreign banks from leaking to the general public. The vociferous libertarian and gold standard advocate Congressman Ron Paul ran a vigorous campaign for Fed transparency, which Bernanke did his best to ward off. Only in June 2009 did the Fed begin publishing regular reports on the uptake of swap lines. The fuller records of the Fed's emergency programs, on which this chapter is based, were not open to the public until December 2010 and March 2011. They were produced as a result of the Dodd-Frank legislation of 2010 and a Freedom of Information suit brought by the Bloomberg News Organization and contested by the Fed and the New York Clearinghouse Association, a banking lobby group, all the way to the Supreme Court. In defense of its secrecy, the Fed argued that revealing the information demanded by Bloomberg would jeopardize its efforts to calm financial markets, because full disclosure would reveal which banks were most in need of its liquidity assistance. The courts ruled in favor of Bloomberg, and the Fed grudgingly complied. The forced disclosure offered an unprecedented glimpse into the operations of the world's key central bank at a moment of maximum stress. The data are a quantified ultrasound of the convulsions of the Atlantic financial system. No such records are available for either the ECB or the Bank of England. Beyond the generalities of systemic stress and stability, they reveal the significance of individual banks, the extent of the pressure they were under, and the scale of the relief the Fed provided. At the top of the Fed's list were Citigroup and Bank of America, and the two highly stressed U.S. investment banks, Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, with their respective London operations. Then came a comprehensive list of the big European and American players in the global dollar banking business. Of the liquidity on one-month or three-month terms that the Fed provided to big banks, European banks took the majority. European banks and the London operations of the major U.S. investment banks accounted for 23% even of the overnight primary dealer credit facility. When this support is added to the gigantic swap line facilities provided for the European central banks, the conclusion is inescapable. What the Fed was struggling to contain in 2008 were not two separate American and European crises, but one gigantic storm in the dollar-based North Atlantic financial system. These data are explosive not only in revealing what was required by the Fed to keep a globalized financial system on the rails, they are remarkable also for the light that they shed on the politics of the bailouts in Europe. In Europe, the bullish CEOs of Deutsche Bank and Barclays claimed exceptional status because they avoided taking aid from their national governments. What the Fed data reveal is the hollowness of those boasts. The banks might have avoided state-sponsored recapitalization, but every major bank in the entire world was taking liquidity assistance on a grand scale from its local central bank, and either directly or indirectly by way of the swap lines from the Fed. Using the Fed's records, we can track the liquidity support provided to a bank like Barclays on a daily basis, revealing a first hump of Fed borrowing during the Bear Stearns crisis and a second in the aftermath of Lehman. The anatomy of the Fed's hidden liquidity support measures also casts in a rather different light the widespread discussion in 2008 about the future of the dollar system. Not surprisingly, in 2008, the United States faced a global chorus of criticism. Advocates of reform argued that at the root of global financial instability was the over-reliance on the dollar as a reserve currency. This conferred on America an exorbitant privilege, which it exploited irresponsibly, running up deficits and borrowing abroad. In 2009, the head of China's central bank and a special commission of the United Nations would advance proposals for a new global currency system. The Russians liked the idea, and so too did the West Europeans. In September, Pierre Steinbrück told journalists, "When we look back 10 years from now, we will see 2008 as a fundamental rupture. I'm not saying the dollar will lose its reserve currency status, but it will become relative." 2 months later, President Sarkozy declared ahead of the G20 summit, "I am leaving tomorrow for Washington to explain that the dollar, which after the Second World War under Bretton Woods was the only currency in the world, can no longer claim to be the only currency in the world. What was true in 1945 cannot be true today." Clearly, the dollar-based financial system had experienced an existential crisis. For avowed skeptics and critics of American power, it was an unmissable opportunity to score points against Anglo-Saxon finance. But given the extraordinarily heavy dependence of both individual banks, such as Deutsche and Paribas, on Fed support, and the huge swap line facility provided to the ECB, it is hard to see how either Steinbrück or Sarkozy could have been more out of touch with reality. By the early 21st century, the dollar's dominance did not rest on the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944 or the institutions like the IMF that issued from it. The foundation of the global dollar was the private banking and financial market network, materialized in the Wall Street City of London nexus. This was a co-creation of American and European finance, deliberately erected beyond state control. What happened in the fall of 2008 was not the relativization of the dollar, but the reverse, a dramatic reassertion of the pivotal role of America's central bank. Far from withering away, the Fed's response gave an entirely new dimension to the global dollar. Steinbrück and Sarkozy may perhaps be forgiven for failing to recognize the significance of the moment, because the Fed had acted without fanfare and without seeking public legitimacy either at home or abroad. The sporadic global debate about alternatives to the dollar was the price that the Fed paid for keeping its stabilization campaign below the radar. On Capitol Hill, while controversy swirled around TARP, there was silence about the Fed's gigantic global liquidity effort. As one senior New York Fed official remarked, it was as if a guardian angel was watching over us. If some members of Congress understood what was going on, they thought better of discussing the Fed's actions openly. The reality of global financial policy disappeared in a spiral of silence, in which it suited both the Fed and its collaborators to bury the reality of massive and explicitly hierarchical interdependence. Chapter 9. Europe's Forgotten Crisis. Eastern Europe. By October 2008, the Fed's swap line facilities defined a relationship of dependence and interdependence between the U.S. central bank and an exclusive club of privileged central bank counterparties. But that posed a question. Who was in and who was out? What were the criteria of membership in the swap line club? On October 28, 2008, Nathan Sheets, the director of the Division of International Finance at the Fed, set out a short list of three criteria. The recipients of swap lines must be 1. Of significant economic and financial mass so that there can be spillover to the US. 2. Well-managed, with prudent policies, so that the problems they have encountered are clearly the result of contagion from US and other advanced economies, and therefore warrant US assistance. 3. The problem faced by local banks should be one of dollar funding stress, so that swap lines would actually make a difference. Ultimately, the Fed had to justify its measures in terms of benefits to the US economy. There were economies that were too small to warrant action. There were countries that were experiencing stress as a result of a collapse of trade or commodity prices that could not be helped by swap lines. But it was point two, with its stress on prudent policy, that offered the scope for political discrimination. What was a prudent policy was very much in the eye of the beholder. As two U.S. analysts attached to the National Intelligence Council remarked at the end of 2009, artificial divisions between economic and foreign policy present a false dichotomy. To whom one extends swap lines is as much a foreign policy as economic decisions. The Fed was well aware that with the swap lines it was treading onto the terrain of geopolitics. Each of the 14 European, Latin American, and Asian central banks included in the swap network was approved by the Treasury and the State Department. They were clearly safe bets. The Fed did everything it could to dissuade further applications. Nevertheless, two further countries did apply and were denied. Their identities are shrouded in secrecy. But there were clearly some countries that were never going to make it onto the Fed's list, no matter how large or hard hit by the crisis they were. On November 14, 2008, Sarkozy hosted President Medvedev of Russia, who was en route to the first leader-level G20 summit in Washington. Sarkozy and Medvedev exchanged congratulations over the peace settlement that Sarkozy had brokered in Georgia in August. But this was not the only topic of Franco-Russian backslapping. Sarkozy also expressed his agreement with recent initiatives from Moscow on the currency question. Over the summer, with the price of oil at all-time highs, Medvedev had been pushing for a diversification of reserve currencies and a greater use of the ruble. Days before arriving in France, Medvedev had given a speech to the Russian parliament in which he drew parallels between the crisis in Georgia and the global financial debacle. They were two very different problems, as Medvedev told the Federal Assembly in November 2008, but they had common features and a common origin, the presumption of an American government that refused to accept criticism and preferred unilateral decisions. This played well with the nationalist gallery in Russia, but there was not much dissent from the European side either. At their summit in Nice, Medvedev noted that on currency issues, the Russian and European positions were practically the same. What he did not mention was that whereas France's banks could count on limitless dollar liquidity from the Fed, the Russians were on their own. If Moscow's increasing assertiveness had been buoyed by oil prices surging to $145 per barrel, the crisis was a severe setback. By the end of 2008, oil prices had plunged, reaching their nadir at $34 on December 21st. With natural resource rents accounting for 20% of Russian GDP, the impact of the commodity price crash was devastating. Tax revenue per metric ton of oil fell by 80%. But the Russian state had the resources to cope. Unlike in 1998, by 2008, Moscow had accumulated enough financial reserves to withstand the pressure of the global crisis. At their peak, Russia's foreign currency holdings were estimated at $600 billion. It was not the state, but Russia's globalized business sector that was in trouble. As oil prices plunged, so did the Russian stock market. By September 15th, the Russian market was already 54% off its peak in May 2008. In the days after Lehman, trading was so jumpy that Moscow regulators took the decision to suspend trading. When the markets reopened on September 19th, jitters continued, with October 6th seeing a single-day fall of 18%. According to one widely quoted estimate, Russia's oligarchs saw their combined wealth slashed from $520 billion at the beginning of 2008 to a mere $148 billion by early 2009. What was spooking investors, apart from oil, was the likely impact of a sharp ruble devaluation on Russian balance sheets. It was the private, not the public, sector that was in danger. By the third quarter of 2008, Russia's banks, raw material producers, and industrial conglomerates had run up external debts of $540 billion, half owed by Russian industrial corporations and the rest by banks. This debt mountain matched Russia's official reserves and was roughly equivalent to Lehman's balance sheet. A substantial fraction was short-term debt. Having adopted the market-based banking model, Russia's banks were particularly at risk, needing to refinance as much as $72 billion due by the end of 2008. Apart from the banks, the list of stressed dollar borrowers included all the major Russian oligopolies. Gazprom, $55 billion, Rosneft, $23 billion, Rusal, $11.2 billion, TNKBP, $7.5 billion, Evraz, $6.4 billion, Norilsk, $6.3 billion, and Lukoil, $6 billion. Collapsing commodity prices slashed their revenues, and a slide in the ruble would put even heavier pressure on those that build in local currency rather than dollars. A major issue for Gazprom, Russia's largest gas supplier. As in the West, the crisis and the terms of the bailout opened the question of the balance of power. To some, it seemed that the Kremlin was bent only on saving the skins of its cronies at the expense of the Russian taxpayer. On this reading, the Russian story was an even more corrupt and brutal version of the drama played out in America. Like the barons of Wall Street, Russia's oligarchs needed state aid, and the regime came to their rescue. It is certainly true that Russia avoided dramatic bankruptcies, and considerable state resources were deployed to make sure of that. But putting events in Russia side by side with those in the United States or Europe, one is struck less by the self-dealing of Russian crisis management than by the frankness with which the question of power was ventilated in Russia and the obvious willingness of President Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin to use the occasion to shift the balance in their favor. Since the breakup of oil conglomerate Yukos in 2003, none of the oligarchs had dared to challenge the Kremlin. Now Medvedev and Putin were turning the screw. They offered financial protection, but they exacted a price. The cornerstone of the Kremlin's crisis-fighting strategy was to prevent a death spiral of devaluation and bankruptcy. In the first phase of the crisis, the central bank deployed its ample foreign currency reserves to stem the fall in the ruble. As a result, as oil prices plunged by 64% between October and December 2008, the ruble lost only 6% against the dollar. Only in January did Moscow let the ruble go, allowing it to devalue by 34% before stabilizing in February. Like any successful rearguard action, it came at a price. The central bank burned $212 billion of its reserves, 35% of the total, to slow the slide. But by so doing, it bought time, allowing dollar-exposed borrowers to pull in their horns and giving the state some time to launch its own response. A key element of this program was a demand from the Kremlin that the oligarchs sink a large part of their fortunes into stabilizing the stock market. There were rumors of an all-night mandatory meeting held in the Kremlin on September 16th, the day of the AIG rescue, at which oligarchs were ordered to plunge cash into their own faltering stocks by collapsing financial institutions directly or simply fork over the cash and/or shares. Following this bail-in of the oligarchs, the government targeted takeovers and bailouts at the smallest and weakest Russian banks. Coordination was provided by state-owned Mnesheconombank, VEB, where Putin, as Russian Prime Minister, served as chairman of the board. $5 billion was used to take over Zvyazbank, Globexbank, and Sobinbank. Then the deposit insurance fund was recapitalized and the insurance limit raised to $28,000. A $50 billion central bank facility put VEB Bank in a position to act as the backstop, with a further $35.4 billion in subordinated debt available at tough rates for troubled oligarch enterprises. The loans would be repayable within a year and otherwise convertible into controlling shares. It was not a government takeover, but a conditional threat and a stark demonstration of where power lay. VEB pumped $4.5 billion into Rusal, the aluminium company majority owned by Oleg Deripaska, to allow it to unwind foreign financing, which it had used to buy a 25% stake in mining giant Norilsk Nickel. VEB also put $2 billion into Mikhail Friedman's Alpha Group to help it pay off Deutsche Bank and rescue Alpha's large stake in Russia's number two mobile phone firm, Vimpelcom, which might otherwise have been forfeited as collateral. As investment plunged and domestic economic activity began to spiral downward, unemployment rates doubled. This was particularly worrying in the so-called monotowns, the urban legacy of Stalinist industrialization. On October 16, 2008, Igor Sechin, Putin's right hand, convened an industry-wide brainstorming session on the car industry at Togliatti, the company town of Avtovaz, the bankrupt inheritor of the Soviet car industry. He announced an immediate $1 billion loan for Avtovaz from VEB that would keep the factory and its staff of 100,000 working. By the end of the crisis, $1.7 billion would be pumped into the Russian auto bailout. In the wake of the oil price shock, the Russian federal budget was reset on the assumption of an average oil price of $41 per barrel, by contrast with the June 2008 budget, which had assumed $95 per barrel. With tax revenues plunging, Putin, as prime minister, took credit for a large fiscal stimulus. A quarter of the government's 9.7 trillion ruble budget was dedicated to crisis spending on work creation, industrial subsidies, and tax cuts. Relative to the size of its economy, commonly compared with that of Spain and roughly comparable to that of Texas, the Russian crisis response was one of the largest in the world, dwarfing those undertaken by West European governments. It was heavily skewed toward the largest, best-connected corporations that were included in a list of 295 nationally important corporations and 1,148 regionally important firms. It was a top-down, corporatist stimulus, and Moscow made clear that it expected the oligarchs to reciprocate. Indeed, it was unafraid to call them out by name. On one notable occasion, Putin singled out four of them as follows: Vladimir Potanin in Taras Holding, Leonid Lebedev, Synthes Group, Mikhail Prokhorov, Onexim Group, and Viktor Vekselberg, Renova Group. I have known all of you for many years. In essence, we have been working jointly. Let me repeat that during the difficult conditions of the crisis, we have made every effort to support you in the various directions of your business. The crisis is waning. It's not yet over, but it's on its way. Now Putin expected them to make good on their commitments. We agreed to meet you halfway in this area as well. We postponed the deadlines for investments. There will be no more such adjustments of schedules. Please focus your utmost attention on meeting your commitments. What would happen if an oligarch failed in his responsibilities was demonstrated in June 2009, when Putin descended on Pikalevo, a small town south of St. Petersburg dominated by the metallurgical empire of Oleg Deripaska. Deripaska, who had once been listed as the richest man in Russia, with a fortune estimated at $28 billion, had seen it reduced to $3.5 billion. But that was no excuse for not paying wages. Indignant workers were blockading the Moscow highway, causing a 250-mile traffic jam. In front of the TV cameras, Putin upbraided Deripaska. Tossing him a pen, the premier demanded that the oligarch sign the paychecks there and then. It was economic management by personal intimidation of the telegenic tub-thumping variety. The message was clear. 10 years on from the humiliation of 1998, there were men in charge who would see to it that things got done. In its way, it was effective. It demonstrated leadership. It humbled the oligarchs. It rallied Russian social interests around the state that provided for them. It kept Prime Minister Putin in the limelight. But was it a long-term strategy for growth? Liberal economists were skeptical. So too was Medvedev, who had succeeded Putin as president in 2008. Even before the crisis, the expert advisers that Medvedev cultivated in his personal entourage had been calling for a new course. In the wake of the crisis, their message was even louder. What had made Russia so vulnerable in 2008 was its lopsided integration into the world economy. On the one hand, its excessive reliance on oil and gas. On the other hand, the corrupt culture of capital flight, in which Russian oligarchs sluiced money in and out of the country through the offshore banking system. How else could one account for the bizarre anomaly that made tiny Cyprus into one of Russia's main sources of foreign investment? What Russia needed was modernization. As Medvedev remarked on September 10, 2009, "Can a primitive economy based on raw materials and economic corruption lead us into the future?" Two-fisted crisis fighting was not enough. A mere recovery from the shock of 2008 would lead nowhere. We need to get out of the crisis by reforming our own economy. What Russia needed was economic transformation, and for that it needed not less but more interaction with the world economy, and above all with its technological leaders. And this had wider implications. After the shocking confrontation with the West in August 2008, Moscow needed to change course. With the crushing of Georgia, the Kremlin had made its point. In the future, Medvedev asserted, the success or failure of Russian foreign policy should be judged by a single criterion: whether it contributes to improving living standards in our country. Rather than puffing out its cheeks to threaten others, Russia should concentrate on attracting foreign technology and capital. It was a message of modernization and partnership that was eagerly taken up both in European capitals and by the new administration in Washington. It might be tempting to conclude that by taming Russia, the effect of the crisis was to calm international relations. And in the short run, this was surely true. But in the international sphere, power is judged by relative standards. And if Russia was hard hit by the 2008 crisis, the impact on Eastern Europe was even worse. The shock to the most highly leveraged transition states of the former communist bloc was staggering. If we compare the forecasts for 2010, made in October 2007, with the expected outturn 2 years later, we see how radically the crisis changed the outlook for the worst-hit countries in the region. The most extreme case was Latvia. 1 year into the crisis, in October 2009, the IMF's forecast for Latvia's GDP in 2010 was 39% lower than it had been in October 2007. Over the same two-year period, Estonia's and Lithuania's GDP expectations were revised downward by a whopping one-third. Slovenia, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria and Romania all experienced downward shocks of between 15 and 18%, more than twice that suffered by the United States. In the adjoining post-Soviet Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, the downward revision of growth expectations ranged from 18% for Russia to 32% for Armenia. The pattern was not uniform. Poland, notably, escaped largely unscathed. But all the most severe casualties of the 2008-2009 crisis are to be found among the transition economies of the former Eastern Bloc. Individually, the East European states are not big economies. But taken together, they formed a substantial unit comparable in economic heft to France or the state of California. They were the pride of Europe's transformation process and the battleground in the new confrontation with Russia that had taken shape between 2007 and 2008. They were eager disciples of market liberalization and financial globalization. That put them especially at risk as global financial markets collapsed. The situation was made even worse, however, by the source of the capital that fueled their growth, the over-leveraged banks of Western Europe. In total, the West European banks and their local branches had $1.3 trillion at stake in emerging Europe, $1.08 trillion excluding Russia. As the balance sheets of the European banks were being crushed on the other side of the Atlantic, the risk was that they would dramatically curtail their operations in Eastern Europe. Before the crisis struck, it was normal to see an average of $50 billion flowing into the emerging markets of Eastern Europe and the post-Soviet world every quarter. In the last quarter of 2008, that suddenly reversed, with an outflow of $100 billion and a further $50 billion in the first quarter of 2009. The pyramid of credit established over the previous 15 years was shaking. In a natural process of adjustment, the floating currencies of Eastern Europe plunged. The result was a catastrophic increase in the local currency cost of servicing international loans. In Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, and Lithuania, foreign loans made up more than half of all credit. As the forint plunged, in a matter of weeks, Hungarian families saw their mortgage and car loan bills surge by 20%. The worst affected were the Hungarian families whose debts were denominated in Japanese yen. They faced a 40% increase in their debt burden as the yen soared. Whereas Russia had reacted to its humiliation in the 1990s by accumulating a substantial currency reserve, the East European states had no such defense. For them, security lay in integration with the West, or at least so they imagined. With the Fed having used swap lines to stabilize a core group of economies in which American interests were undeniable, one might have expected the ECB to extend similar support to the East European neighbors of the Eurozone. Certainly this was the expectation of the Fed. If one applied the three criteria set out by Nathan Sheets to Eastern Europe, the case for ECB assistance was clear-cut. The East Europeans were EU members and aspired to future Eurozone membership. As such, the respectability of their economic policy was vouched for in general terms. The crisis in Eastern Europe was immediately caused by a sudden stop in foreign credit supply, and the Eurozone's own banks were deeply involved and stood to suffer substantial losses. The risk of blowback was acute. As Sheets remarked to the FOMC, "I think it is very appropriate for all the European EMEs to report to the ECB for their liquidity needs." But whereas the Fed had effectively licensed the ECB to issue dollars, the ECB had no intention of extending equivalent privileges to Poland or Romania. With Sweden and Denmark, the ECB established publicly announced swap lines. Their banks would supply liquidity to Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, the central banks of Poland and Hungary were fobbed off with repo arrangements that treated them no better than stressed commercial banks in need of extra liquidity. The only assistance that the ECB was willing to provide was to give them short-term funding in exchange for first-class, euro-denominated securities. When the problem was a shortage of euro funding, that was not a great help. What they needed was a swap facility for Hungarian forint or Polish zloty. Even the limited facilities offered by the ECB were extracted only thanks to urgent pressure from the Austrian and French central banks, which had particular reason to worry about the losses their banks might suffer on their East European portfolios. Austria's banks were in particular difficulty because they had made loans in Swiss francs, funding them with borrowing in Switzerland, where interest rates were low. Now, the Swiss franc was soaring and funding was scarce. To tide them over, the Swiss central bank offered full currency swap lines in exchange for euros, but not for Polish zlotys or Hungarian forints. Membership in the EU and NATO was supposed to have promoted Eastern Europe from their inferior status in the global pecking order. Ex-members of the Warsaw Pact and former Soviet republics had eagerly refashioned themselves as exponents of Donald Rumsfeld's New Europe. They now found their prospects for growth shattered, and their governments thrown back to where their post-communist careers had begun, as lesser sovereigns, and more or less resentful supplicants for international financial assistance. The IMF was their last resort. This was traumatic. No one in Eastern Europe wanted to relive the bitter aftermath of the collapse of communism with which the IMF was indelibly associated. The first and most desperate application for assistance from within the EU was Hungary's. On October 27, 2008, Budapest reached agreement with the IMF and the EU, as opposed to the ECB, on a $25 billion loan package. At 20% of Hungarian pre-crisis GDP, it was a very substantial commitment and an unusually generous multiple of Hungary's IMF capital quota. The IMF considered the program to be unusually lenient. Unsurprisingly, the Hungarians did not see it in such favorable terms. Hungarian politics polarized as the austerity program bit. The nationalist daily, Magyar Írlap, described Hungary as being slowly garrotted by a credit noose around our necks. For the extremists of Hungary's far right, it was a short step back in time from the neo-colonialism of the EU and the IMF to the Treaty of Trianon, which had eviscerated Hungary after World War I. In 2010, the right-wing Fidesz party would reap the benefits with a crushing electoral victory, setting Hungary on the path to a self-declared illiberal democracy. The IMF's Hungarian aid package of October 2008 was followed by programs for Iceland, Latvia, Ukraine, and Pakistan. In 2009, Armenia, Belarus, and Mongolia would be forced to apply to the IMF for help. Less than a year after it had played host to the contentious NATO summit, Bucharest found itself negotiating an IMF program. Precautionary credits would be offered to Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Serbia, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. Additionally, at the urging of Washington, a new, minimally invasive, flexible credit facility offering a total of more than $80 billion in ready cash was made available to Mexico, Poland, and Colombia. Mexico thus had the singular distinction of receiving both a swap line and an IMF credit facility. Thanks to the IMF and EU intervention, an immediate meltdown was avoided on the East European periphery of Europe in the fall of 2008. But the situation remained extremely precarious, and it was dangerous not only to the borrowers. Austria's adventurous banks had since the 1990s accumulated claims on Eastern Europe equal to more than 55% of Austrian GDP. The exposure of Austrian banks to Hungary and Romania, the countries with flexible exchange rates that seemed most likely to suffer payment shock, came to 20% of Austria's GDP. German, French, and Italian banks all had large claims on Eastern Europe, but these were manageable in relation to domestic resources. The other lender that was seriously exposed was Sweden, whose banks had almost entirely monopolized the banking markets of the Baltics, feeding a roaring real estate boom. There was acute anxiety on the part of international agencies such as the World Bank and the Bank for European Reconstruction and Development that an abrupt withdrawal by one or more stressed West European banks could precipitate a chain reaction that would overwhelm the modest resources provided by the IMF and the EU Commission. Desperate to reduce leverage on all fronts, West European banks would pull out of Eastern Europe en masse, unleashing a ruinous rush to the exit. Bob Zelig, George Bush's nominee to head the World Bank, was deeply concerned about Europe's future. "It's 20 years after Europe was united in 1989," Zelig reminded the readers of the Financial Times in early 2009. "What a tragedy if you allow Europe to split again." The new Europe, which the United States and the two Bush presidencies in particular had been fostering since the end of the Cold War, was in jeopardy. Evoking a different chapter in Europe's history, the Viennese press was warning of a monetary Stalingrad that threatened Austria's and Italy's banks. The situation was serious. But the alarmist talk in Central Europe was also a reflection of the fact that Western Europe wasn't listening. Berlin was no more enthusiastic about a collective European solution in Eastern Europe than it had been in the Eurozone. Germany shot down Austrian and Hungarian initiatives for a common support fund. "Not our problem," Peer Steinbrück announced. East Europeans did not fail to notice that as a Eurozone member, Greece seemed to be weathering the storm rather better than Hungary, even though its financial fundamentals were no better. In early 2009, there were calls, ironic in light of later events, for Poland and other East European EU members to be put on a fast track to Eurozone membership, thus bringing them under the protective umbrella of the ECB. A confidential IMF staff report backed the proposal, arguing that, for countries in the EU, Euroization offers the largest benefits in terms of resolving the foreign currency debt overhang, accumulation, removing uncertainty, and restoring confidence. Without euroization, addressing the foreign debt currency overhang would require massive domestic retrenchment in some countries against growing political resistance. But no help was to be expected from the ECB. It had no interest in entangling itself in Eastern Europe. In December 2008, the most exposed Italian and Austrian banks began clamouring for a concerted programme of international assistance. Finding the door closed in Brussels, they turned to Vienna, which, given the extent of Austria's entanglement, could not afford to let things slide. Circumventing Brussels, the Austrian government announced what became known as the Vienna Initiative. This multilateral scheme committed the World Bank, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and the European Investment Bank to a programme of 24.5 billion euros in new lending and capital injections. Crucially, it was flanked by an agreement with at least some of the leading private banks. On a case-by-case basis, the Vienna Initiative extracted pledges from the leading lenders that they would maintain their lines of credit to the region, thus preventing an even more dramatic credit stop. UniCredit and Banca Intesa of Italy, Raiffeisen of Austria, and Swedbank of Sweden all participated. Commerzbank of Germany and Deutsche Bank did not. As it turned out, the most important battleground for East European stabilisation was a long way from Vienna. As the 21st century began, Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia had seemed like the lucky ones. Unlike other former Soviet republics, such as Ukraine, Georgia or Belarus, they had successfully transitioned to full membership in both the EU and NATO. Furthermore, unlike Hungary or Poland, the Baltics were eager to join the euro as soon as possible. In anticipation, they had pegged their currencies. In 2008, despite the sudden stop to foreign capital inflows, they were under great pressure to remain on their convergence track. But as foreign credit dried up, maintaining their fixed exchange rates became ever more painful. When, in early 2008, the IMF had contemplated the possibility of a crisis triggered by macroeconomic imbalances, Latvia, with its yawning current account deficit, had been singled out as particularly vulnerable. Then it had been viewed in isolation as a national problem case. Now Latvia faced the unwinding of its huge deficits in the context of a comprehensive global crisis that had forced its regional competitors in Poland, Hungary and Romania to devalue. If the Baltics did not follow suit, how were they to keep up? How would they cope without foreign funding? How could they regain export competitiveness and shrink imports if they could not adjust their currencies against the euro? Without devaluation, the only way to right the trade balance was by rebalancing domestic demand, cutting wages, raising taxes, and slashing government spending. This was painful, but given the advanced stage of financial integration that the Baltic countries had already reached, devaluation was dangerous too. With 80% of credit outstanding sourced from their European neighbours, any substantial depreciation was likely to trigger wholesale default. The cost of servicing their debts in euros would simply have become prohibitive. Though they were not yet members of the eurozone, in early 2009 the Baltics faced a predicament that was a grim precursor of things to come. Because of the scale of its debts and the deep involvement of Scandinavian banks, Latvia was commonly seen as the key to stability in the Baltics. If it abandoned its peg, contagion would most likely spread to Estonia and Lithuania, and from there to Slovakia and Bulgaria, which were also struggling to hold their currencies in line with the euro. Once a wave of further devaluations began, it would be impossible to uphold the defences put in place by the Vienna Initiative. Fire sales would sweep Eastern Europe. Some might get out alive. But for two of Sweden's most important banks, Swedbank and Nordea, the entanglement with the Baltics was existential. If their loans were written off, the capital of both banks would be completely wiped out. As a BNP Paribas analyst put it, Latvia may be a small country, but it has vast repercussions. One Central European Minister of Finance, who preferred to remain anonymous, predicted that the chain reaction across Central and Eastern Europe would take down at least half a dozen European banks. Latvia would play the role of a Lehman, or, even more ominously, that of the infamous Austrian Kreditanstalt in the financial crisis of 1931, the failure of which had precipitated Weimar Germany's final slide toward disaster. For the IMF, the standard prescription for a country in Latvia's position was a one-off devaluation followed by debt restructuring or rescheduling. But the European Commission dug in its heels. Latvia was en route to Eurozone membership. It must stay the course. If it needed to rebalance its current account, it must do so through deflation and austerity. The results for Latvia were drastic. By the summer of 2009, house prices had plunged by 50%. Civil servants, including one-third of the country's teachers, were fired, and public salaries were slashed by 35%. Unemployment surged from 5 to 20%. Remarkably, Latvia clung on, as did its neighbours. In mounting its defence, Latvia received aid totalling 32% of its pre-crisis GDP. 3.1 billion euros came from the European Commission. The IMF provided 1.7 billion. 0.8 billion came from the World Bank and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And 1.9 billion came from Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Estonia. They all preferred to fight the crisis in Latvia rather than bailing out their banks at home. Significantly, the ECB absented itself from the crisis-fighting coalition. The financial austerity course imposed a huge pressure on the new democracies of the Baltics. In Latvia, popular discontent with the new austerity line and accusations of corruption against the political class led to two referenda calling for protection of pensions and a public right to dissolve the parliament by plebiscite. In January 2009, Riga was rocked by mass protests that escalated into rioting and a night of street battles with police. In February, a conservative coalition government took office under the high-profile member of the European Parliament, Valdis Dombrovskis. His government's objective was to stay the course of austere conformity. "We are facing national bankruptcy. It's going to be tough," Dombrovskis told the nation. What, after all, was the alternative? The legacy of the Soviet period hung over Latvia. Georgia was a reminder. For the Baltics, the choice was between a Western or an Eastern hegemon. Since the 1990s, they had managed, miraculously, to navigate their way under the umbrella of the EU and NATO. At least as far as the Latvian political class was concerned, they intended to stay there. Faced with a double crisis of 2008, the reaction of Eastern Europe was not uniform. The Baltics stayed the course. Hungarian nationalism rebelled. But nowhere was the double shock more jarring than in Ukraine. The coincidence of the escalation of geopolitical tension between Russia and the West with the financial crisis dealt a shuddering blow to its fragile polity. The route to the Ukraine crisis of 2013 was twisted, but the path that it would travel down was mapped out already 5 years earlier. In the spring of 2008, the decision by Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko to apply for NATO membership, eagerly applauded by the Bush administration, Poland, and the other East Europeans, split Ukrainian politics. Whereas President Yushchenko threw in his lot with the West, Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko favoured the policy of balance between Russia and the West that Kiev had pursued since independence.